Thank you, Dr. Danke, for these very warm words of welcome. I'm very glad to have this opportunity, ladies and gentlemen, to be with you tonight in order to tell you something about the background of this very declaration which just has been mentioned to you. On March 4th, 1970, a then still unknown association of theologians called the Theological Convention was assembled for its third meeting in Frankfurt in West Germany. Unanimously, they accepted a statement which very soon came to be known all over the world as the Frankfurt Declaration. Only few people ever realized that its full title is Frankfurt Declaration on the Fundamental Crisis in Christian Mission. But most of them became quite aware that it was dealing with this crisis. For the last 10 or 15 years, many books and articles had been written, and many lectures had been given about the crisis in missions. But none of these stirred up any commotion comparable with the almost explosive reaction to the Frankfurt Declaration. Suddenly, some people in their apologetic replies even started doubting whether such crisis in mission really existed. Therefore, they added a question mark to the otherwise so familiar phrase. What was the reason for this unexpected change of mind? In contrast to the prior description of the post-war crisis in missions, the Frankfurt Declaration gave a much more radical diagnosis. It did not primarily see the root of this crisis in the changed historical situation or in the captivity of missions in outdated structures. Rather, it claimed that the real damage was a crack in the most elementary foundations of missions, namely an insidious falsification in the basic assumptions of Christian faith, which threatens to pervert the entire work of missionary responsibility. And such diagnosis could not be bypassed easily. It could be confirmed by people with the same apprehension. It could cause other people to be shocked by making them aware of the seriousness of the situation. Or it could be taken as an accusation of one's own new conception of it. But it could not simply be ignored. This is the reason why this document soon received an attention which none of the first signers had anticipated. In my introduction tonight into the history, theology, and effect of the Declaration, I will have to answer four questions. Firstly, what was the primary cause and aim? Secondly, what does the Frankfurt Declaration want to affirm and to disclaim? Thirdly, what were the reactions and effects? Fourthly, is there still a further function of the Frankfurt Declaration? So, first of all, what was the primary cause and aim? I still very vividly remember the deep shock which I received when I, in one of the last nights in February 1968, read the draft for Section 2 of the 4th General Assembly of the WCC, which was to be held in Uppsala in July that year. The title of that draft, designed by the staff of the Commission on World Mission and Evangelism in Geneva, was Renewal in Mission. But at once it appeared to me to be a total distortion of mission and an entire disruption of the whole tradition of missiological thinking which was embodied in the documents of the preceding World Missionary Conferences from Edinburgh in 1910 until Mexico City in 1963. No reference was made to the basic affirmation that mission is the participation in the sending of the triune God. There was no pointing out of the clear eschatological nature of Christian mission work. The statements of Jesus as the man for others had a very strong humanistic flavor, where a new Jesuanism took the place of the full Christology. as to its aim, the primary task of proclaiming the gospel in order to lead people to repent and to accept Christ's offer of atonement and faith. This was superseded by the new idea that the Church's mission consists primarily in its involvement in the field of tension in society. At the same time, the unfinished task to evangelize the multitudes of the three continents which never had heard the gospel or only got very little knowledge of it was completely forgotten. Today, I have learned to look more critically even at the ambiguity in the statements of the earlier missionary conferences. But up to then, I was a sincere adherent of the ecumenical cause which had mustered so many of the great charismatic church leaders of this century. Thus, in my concluding lecture on the history of the ecumenical movement, which I had to give that winter term, I told to my students the next morning, "This Geneva draft will either be outrightly rejected by the assembly delegates in Uppsala, or it will be changed beyond recognition." Ladies and gentlemen, I'm no prophet, but at that time I was almost about to become one. For it was not only me who was annoyed by this bravado of the author, Dr. Walter Hollenbeger, and his associates. There came protests from many sides. A group of Scandinavian mission leaders even composed an alternative draft, and there came many proposals for major amendments from other countries. Just in time for the meeting, Dr. McGavran challenged the assembly delegates by his provoking article in Church Growth Bulletin, "Will Uppsala betray the 2 billions?" It was on account of this article I got into closer contact with him, and in our correspondence for the first time the idea was developed that German missionary leaders should do something similar to what the Witten Congress had done 2 years ago when passing their famous Witten Declaration. Why was there still need for a second document of this kind? In fact, it has rightly been observed that the Witten Declaration anticipated most points of the Frankfurt Declaration. In some aspects, the Witten Declaration gives more guidance than the Frankfurt Declaration. As to its contents and character, the main difference is that the Witten Declaration speaks of a current theological and missiological issues in general, whilst the Frankfurt Declaration focuses its attention directly on the development of mission theology, which is expounded in the more recent and avant-gardistic publications of the Division of World Mission and Evangelism. There is also a certain difference in theology. Some of you will be familiar with the article which Dr. G. wrote in your Concordia Bulletin. He stated that the Frankfurt Declaration is the German version of the Witten Declaration. Well, I would say, indeed, there is a distinct German element in it, in as far as Lutheran theology has made a strong contribution to it. So, for example, the sacramental dimension of the Church's ministry is strongly accentuated, or at least referred to, over against some anti-sacramental statements in the Witten Declaration, especially in its article about neo-Romanism. But another even more important difference is the fact that the Witten Declaration is a self-expression of that great bulk of conservative evangelical missions which had already organized itself separately from the more traditional Geneva-linked missions, the EFMA and the IFMA. The Frankfurt Declaration, however, from the beginning wanted to take its position within the ecumenical mission movement and therefore to readjust its course from inside. Now, it would not have been for the first time that German mission leaders voiced their theological objection to the pronouncements of great international missionary conferences. Under the leadership of men like Karl Hartenstein, Karl Heim, a famous dogmatician at Tübingen University, Karl Hartenstein, the director of the Basel mission, and Walter Freitag, professor in Hamburg and chairman of the German Missionary Council, German delegation had voiced their protest both at the Jerusalem and Madras conferences in 1928 and 1938. Finally, after World War II, they really started to receive attention for their eschatological criticism of the optimistic inner worldly conceptions of the majority of other delegates. Unfortunately, the voice of Martin Luther's Germany was not to be heard in Uppsala Section 2. A church delegate from Sumatra, who desperately fought for a mission understanding relevant to the tremendous evangelistic opportunities in Indonesia, looked in vain for support from his German colleagues. He had taken his doctorate in Heidelberg. This time, it was an evangelical Anglican, the Reverend John R.W. Stott, who made the most piercing pronouncement in the assembly and really managed to modify the final report to some extent. But even this report, which totally put aside the original draft, was far from being satisfactory to the Reformation's point of view. It was a rather clumsy and inconsistent compromise of the different opinions uttered in this section. And commentators were unanimous that the report on Section 2 was the weakest of all the six Uppsala section reports. It had a definite secularist slanting given to it by the Geneva-inclined editorial committee, especially in subsections 2 and 3. And I did not manage to get to Uppsala myself, although I had not only got my missiological doctorate from Uppsala, but also my wife. But when I read the reports from the meeting and heard the personal impressions of some delegates, I realized that something had to be done to prevent the Commission of World Mission and Evangelism from totally being captured by the theology of secularization, which had growingly determined its course since New Delhi 1961, which means ever since the old IMC was integrated into the World Council of Churches. Thus, I wrote that little book, which in Germany had the title Humanisierung, einzige Hoffnung der Welt, and in English, as you are familiar with now, Missions Which Way. It received the recommendations of two outstanding German Lutheran mission professors, Dr. Fietzedom of Neuengettelsau and Dr. Moritzen of Erlangen University, and was, as the latter of them wrote, a call of alarm. It wanted to awaken the whole of the fellowship of German Protestant Mission Societies, the Deutscher Evangelischer Missionstag, and to stir them into action. As member organization of the CWME, they should be mindful of their responsibility for its theological course and do their utmost to correct it. In the final chapter, I directly wrote, a forceful document analogous to the Wheaton Declaration should be worked out. On its basis, the Commission should be induced to listen to the objections and to answer to them in a responsible way. If the document is well supported by its signers, it could or even ought to lead to a decisive theological reorientation in the working program for the Geneva Division and its regional councils. But strangely enough, nothing seemed to happen. This does not mean that the call of alarm was not heard. I had sent copies with personal dedications to the leaders of the German Missionary Council and also to Dr. Walter Hollenbeger to Geneva, pleading for more dialogue. At least Geneva was alarmed. A top-level delegation was sent to German mission headquarters in Hamburg in order to confer with them what should be the reaction to that little book. The author was not invited. The executive secretary of the German Missionary Council, who is wholeheartedly in agreement with the present cause in Geneva, advised them to pay no public attention to the book, for then it would pass by almost unnoticed. Thus the German Missionary Council did not respond. The newly established Conference of Evangelical Missions, where 35 evangelical mission societies had organized themselves, was basically in favor with the issue. But they were still struggling to get settled and had nobody to go deeply into the issue. At this juncture, one last avenue was opening up, the Theological Convention. It was a group of conservative theologians, most of them Lutherans, some in academic, some in pastoral positions, which was convened through the militant confession movement No Other Gospel, in order to give theological leadership in our present anti-modernist church struggle in Germany. Already at our first meeting in March 1969, we had realized that this church struggle is no domestic affair, but that it had already affected the whole ecumenical movement. We had a subcommittee on mission and ecumenics which watchfully observed the present development. Other members of that committee are Professor Fietzedom and Professor Winterhager. It was this committee which was asked to prepare a document which should clearly point out the theological issues at stake in the ecumenical cause of missions. When the draft had been circulated by correspondence, it was presented to the plenary meeting and, after some amendments, adopted by the convention. A few days later, it was sent out to all German missionary societies. We asked them to test our thesis on the basis of their biblical foundation and also the accuracy of our description of the current errors in churches, missions, and in the ecumenical movement. In the event of their concurrence, we requested them to sign the declaration and to secure their validity as guiding principle of missionary thought and action. 2 months later, the Frankfurt Declaration was translated into English and sent to Dr. McGavin in view of a possible circulation in America. It did indeed appear both in the Church Growth Bulletin and in Christianity Today on June 19, 1970, later also in the Concordia Bulletin and other church magazines. Because of the preeminent place and the high acclamation given to it, both by Dr. McGavin and the editor of Christianity Today, Dr. Harold Binsell, it soon received attention in other continents as well. Now the Frankfurt Declaration had started its real course all over the earth. Now secondly, what does the Frankfurt Declaration want to affirm and to disclaim? The Frankfurt Declaration has no ambition to proclaim a new theological understanding of mission by using modern philosophical categories. It does not refer to current attempts to develop an indigenous theology in Asia and Africa. Neither does it present a strategy of action to master the practical task of world mission today. Much criticism raised against the Frankfurt Declaration has not observed that this was not meant as such a document for a strategy, but rather a reactionary statement. It has no other aim but to reaffirm the consensus about the biblical basis, content, and goal of mission, which in spite of occasional distortion was the inspiring motive of the whole Protestant missionary movement from the Pietistic revival in the beginning of the 18th century until the pronouncements on mission by the second WCC assembly at Evanston in 1954. It is rooted in the Lutheran concept of the distinction between the objective atonement on Calvary and its subjective application by the administration of the means of grace, which are to be accepted by faith in order to become efficacious to the individual here and now. I was astonished to read the comment of a certain committee of the Missouri Synod that just in this fourth thesis, they sense a certain influence of Armenian theology. None of us has ever read Arminius, and I don't think that this suggestion is right. We had, in fact, had a long debate just on these questions raised in thesis number 4. And some of our fellow workers who were most solidly grounded in the traditional Lutheran dogmatics attracted our attention to the traditional Lutheran distinction between the acquisitio salutis and the applicatio salutis, which has been forgotten by the universalistic approach under Barthian influence in the ecumenical movement, by which the whole world is already saved once and for all on Calvary, and the only difference is that some people know it, others don't. Now this concept of the distinction between acquisitio and applicatio salutis is placed into the eschatological understanding of the history of salvation as it was developed by evangelical biblical scholars from Count Zinzendorf up to Oskar Kullmann, which means that mission is the decisive calling of the Christian church between the ascension and the second coming of Jesus Christ. The Frankfurt Declaration firmly holds to the authority and unity of the scripture and does not heed to its dissolution by so-called higher criticism or demythologization. It is based upon the finality of God's revelation and atoning work in Jesus Christ and the validity of his commission as the unchanging norm of our action. Its authors are convinced that between Christ's sending of the apostles and his return, the priorities of the missionary mandate of the church and also the content of his message remain the same. The Frankfurt Declaration does not aim at giving a complete system of mission theology, and therefore some of you will have looked in vain to find your favorite points in theology. Rather, it articulates the biblical understanding of mission with particular reference to exactly those points which are questioned today by heretical undercurrents in church, theology, mission, ecumeny, and para-ecclesiastical movements. It is true, the immediate object of criticism are the recent documents of the Commission of World Mission and Evangelism, especially those for the study project on the missionary structures of the church, which was inaugurated at the New Delhi Conference in 1961. Its most important publications are Thomas Wiese's Planning for Mission and Walter Hollenbeger, the Church for Others, and of course the original draft for Section 2 in Uppsala. But the opinions voiced in these documents are not the personal idiosyncrasies of those authors. They rather form part of an almost universal heretical wave which in its threat to the Christian Church can only be compared with the Gnostic movement in the second century or the era of rationalism. The most notorious elements of this complex, which some of you in our class discussions referred as the spirit of our time, are the shrinkage of the transcendental consciousness, the neo-rationalistic dissolution of scriptural authority, the secularist leveling down of biblical statements of faith into a sociological understanding of world and history, a watering down of the uniqueness of biblical revelation by pan-religious or situationalist perspectives, the syncretistic transformation of Christology and pneumatology into general forces seen at work in the process of historical change, usually referred to by the phrase, what Christ is doing out there in the world, the reduction of the divine nature of the church to a mere instrumentality, the falsification of eschatological prophecies into evolutionist utopias, and above all, the hideous exchange of the basic theocentric dimension of biblical faith into a self-centered humanism. This substitution of the theocentric dimension by the humanism with the vaguely Christological motivation, has been brought very clearly, brought out very clearly in the commentary given to the original draft for the report of section 2 in Uppsala. Let me therefore quote that statement. "We have lifted up humanization as the goal of mission because we believe that more than other positions, it communicates in our period of history the meaning of the messianic goal. In another time, the goal of God's redemptive work might best have been described in terms of man turning towards God. The fundamental question was that of the true God, and the Church responded to that question by pointing to him. It was assuming that the purpose of mission was Christianization, bringing man to God through Christ and his Church. Today, the fundamental question is much more that of true man, and the dominant concern of the missionary congregation must therefore be to point to the humanity in Christ as the goal of mission." The Frankfurt Declaration, therefore, is an all-out attack on the ecumenical program of humanization. But it does not attack it on account of its concern for a more human, harmonious relation between man and man in society. Its fury is inspired by the discovery that the real humanization which is advocated is not the humanization of society, but rather the humanization of God, or, in other words, the deification of man. The basic Christological creed, "God became man," is perverted into the slogan already insinuated by the snake in the Garden of Eden, that man becomes God. In the theology of secularization, which has become the dominant school of thought in the ecumenical movement, we are confronted with a complete swallowing up of the vertical by the horizontal dimension. All statements of this theology, even if they, for the sake of accommodation, still use the traditional theological vocabulary, and this is why we have to be so very sensitive to this theological double talk. All statements are talking about man and only about man and his possibilities. This theology seeks God everywhere, in the existential questions of modern man, in the social change, in non-violent and also in bloody revolutions. But it does not seek him where he wants to be found first of all, in his word which became flesh in Jesus Christ, and in his congregation of saints, which is gathered around the biblical preaching of the gospel and the Lord's table. And if it refers to Jesus Christ, to his death, resurrection, and coming for judgment, it is still not really concerned with himself, but it uses these traditional statements as a general pattern in a paradigmal way, according to which the life of the Christians and of the Church should be modeled in their political involvement in society. Therefore, the person and work of Jesus often can be compared or even be substituted by the example, as we heard at the Geneva Tapes this afternoon, by the examples of Che Guevara and Mao Zedong. It is the apprehension of the imminent danger that these currents are going to infiltrate more and more the self-understanding of missions and to capture their course, which explains the confessional character of the Frankfurt Declaration when it says, "We recognize and declare, we oppose, or we refute." Its authors are convinced that what is at stake here is the being or not being, not only of the present organizations of mission, but of the future of the Christian Church, and also of the Christian faith in general. At the end of 1970, I was visited by the former General Secretary of the IMC and the first Director of the Commission of World Mission and Evangelism, Bishop Leslie Newbegin. And he questioned me about the nature of the Frankfurt Declaration. And he said, "Now, why should you come out in such a polemical way, being so apodictic? Why couldn't you have come with a much more positive statement, asking questions rather than to come with pleas and ambiguity? I responded to Bishop Newbegin and said, you will remember Bishop Newbegin, the famous Bauman Declaration in 1934, which in fact is the model after which the external structure of the Frankfurt Declaration has been shaped. Now, would you say that the same applies then also to that statement, that they should have asked questions rather than confessed their faith and rejected the heresies of that time? Bishop Newbegin replied, yes, if a satanic ideology tries to infiltrate the church and to destroy it from inside, then there is no other way than responsible churchmen coming and make a confessional statement. And we answered, or I answered, Bishop Newbegin, you have exactly described the apprehension of the authors, although we have not expressed it in that way. Therefore, it would not do from a safe objective distance to analyze this document and put grading marks to its points. For this would bring us into the fatal neighborhood of the scribes who were straining out gnats and swallowing camels. Only he has understood its concern who realizes that it is a last signal of alarm given at the most fatal turning point of church history. Now thirdly, what were the reactions and effects? When we in March 1970 sent out the first mimeograph copies, we did not anticipate the tremendous echo which the declaration received in a very short time. Small and large quantities were ordered by mission societies, church boards and synods, by Christian organizations, parishes, and single Christians. It appeared in several periodicals. Soon the signatures started pouring in. There were many, but there would have been more if the Protestant German Missionary Council had not indicated its dissent immediately, so that people feared to oppose their real sympathy. The loudest approval came from Lutheran and from other evangelical mission societies. Amongst the first societies which sent their approval was the Leipzig Mission in East Germany, the Neuen Bettel, our mission in Bavaria, and the leaders of the Breslau Mission, and also the whole seminary, theological seminary of the Evangelical Lutheran Free Church in Oberhausen. Some of the evangelical mission societies hesitated for a while to give their signature because they sensed a certain sacramental emphasis in the declaration which did not fully correspond with their particular doctrinal convictions, although they were in fundamental agreement with the main course of the argument. We also received letters of appreciation which revealed what people found most helpful in the Frankfurt Declaration. They indicated that the declaration had unmasked and articulated some tendencies in contemporary theological thinking which had disquieted them before, but which they had not been able clearly to identify. This unmasking effect was not confined to the realm of mission, but was of equal relevance also in many other spheres, like sermons, religious instruction, diaconate, Christian literature, youth work, sexual ethics, and so on. This showed that the same humanistic and sociological ideologies had gained inroads also in all other spheres of church life. Because of this, Landesbischof Dietz Felbinger, head of the German Protestant churches, and especially the Bavarian Lutheran Church, expressed his particular appreciation of the doctrine. He commended it warmly to his church workers and wanted even to use it as a text to bring about a new orientation in the spiritual confusion of the evangelic churches in Germany. Unfortunately, because of the lack of readiness to cooperate from the side of the German Missionary Council, his proposal was turned down. The whole year following the publication of the Frankfurt Declaration was filled by many public debates on it in assemblies, executive committees, study groups, theological seminaries, and church synods. This effect was particularly satisfactory because for the first time the theological foundation of mission had become a major issue again. For several years, the changing of structures had seemed to be the all-important subject for churches and missions. And some people jokingly remarked a new theology had developed around the theme sola structura. The widest result, however, was the fact that the blast of the Frankfurt Declaration resounded from many other countries and continents of the world. The echo from the United States materialized in almost as many signatures as we had received from Germany. Besides many mission societies, the entire Association of Evangelical Professors of Mission endorsed their support. Soon the document was translated to most other European languages. The Italian one was prepared by the Vatican's Congregatio de Propaganda Filii in order to enable Paul VI to read it in his mother tongue. Commentaries appeared in several mission periodicals. Equally satisfactory was the echo from Asia. When I followed the request of the Evangelical Lutheran Church on New Guinea, to visit their mission field last year, several other countries in Asia and Australia added their invitation to my schedule. In most places, the first topic requested was an introduction to the Frankfurt Declaration. In the meantime, it had also been translated into Asian languages like Japanese, Chinese, Indonesian, Pakistani. I found that the Frankfurt Declaration had the same polarizing effect in Asia as it had in Germany. Some people would deplore this as a faithful separation and accuse us for splitting the church. Others welcomed it as a necessary tool to discern the spirit. Personally, I rejoice that just on the basis of the Frankfurt Declaration, a real worldwide brotherhood of people was emerging who discovered themselves to be involved in the same theological and ecclesiastical struggle. They now realized that they had not been misguided in their apprehensions and critical diagnosis of the present ecumenical trend, which appeared to have become almost omnipresent and omnipotent. There was only one quarter from where no public reaction was heard. This was the very receipt of the Frankfurt Declaration, namely the World Council of Churches and its mission department. In an interview with a German Christian journalist, the director of the Commission on World Mission and Evangelism, the Reverend Philip Potter, stated that he found in the Frankfurt Declaration a profound lack of Christian politeness, because no attempt had been made to discuss its issues with the Geneva staff. Reverend Potter did not mention, however, that the same issues had been voiced in vain by evangelicals at the Uppsala meeting, and that these issues had been pointed out 6 months prior to the appearance of the Frankfurt Declaration in the book Missions Which Way. Above all, he did not reveal that the Theological Convention, in letters to the General Secretaries of the WCC and of the Lutheran World Federation, had offered to send a delegation to Geneva in order to have a responsible top-level deliberation on the issues of the Frankfurt Declaration. This offer was treated dilatorily and finally not accepted. You can read about this in the account written by the Reverend G. in your Concordia bulletin. Nor did the readers of the official ecumenical periodicals, for example the IRM or the Ecumenical Review, or the Ecumenical Press Service ever get a chance to read the Frankfurt Declaration unless they had got hold of it through other sources. Ladies and gentlemen, in an age where this term dialogue seems to have become the most important word in the ecumenical vocabulary and strategy, such dialogue was not granted to a group of concerned theological scholars who most sincerely had fought for it. Buddhists, Marxists, and men of other religions and ideologies have been much more fortunate in their ecumenical treatment. I must, however, for fairness sake, add that the Commission on World Mission and Evangelism has invited me to attend its forthcoming World Conference at Bangkok, and that I have accepted this invitation. I hope that the conference theme, Salvation Today, will offer the opportunity to voice the gravamina of the Frankfurt Declaration, although they most likely will be soaked up in the swamps of ecumenical pluralism. Therefore, we still hold on, maintaining the necessity of a responsible confrontation over the Frankfurt Declaration itself, where both sides are equally and responsibly represented. Now, my final point is there still a further function of the Frankfurt Declaration. One might argue that my last statement sounds both stubborn and anachronistic. Has not the Frankfurt Declaration, like other contemporary statements, had its time, while new issues are coming up which demand new approaches and answers? Although it feels a bit awkward to appear pleading one's own case, I definitely do not think that the Frankfurt Declaration has no further function anymore. Just during the last few weeks, the Declaration has once more been the focus of some very significant developments, both in Germany and in overseas. Recently, I received a letter from Bandung in Indonesia stating that the Frankfurt Declaration had just been sent out to 2,000 Indonesian clergymen and missionaries. The churches in Indonesia up to now have been quite homogeneously orthodox in their Reformed theology, or in the case of the Batak Church, Lutheran or mild Lutheran theology, but even the Indonesian Council of Churches, the DGI, has developed an evangelistic concern in view of the unique openings during the last 7 years. But today, they are also affected by the ecumenical ferment. The Ecumenical Institute of Chicago in Singapore is working hard to speed up this process. Bangkok, too, is throwing its shadows ahead, and some concerned theologians feel that it is time that Indonesian Christians become aware of the new ideological conflicts which are threatening the life and mission of the Church. Here the Frankfurt Declaration is regarded as one of the most helpful tools for this theological conscientization. Another most heartening development has taken place in Germany itself in February 1972. I've mentioned that in the beginning, some evangelical mission societies had hesitated to sign the Frankfurt Declaration because of some reservation in theological points of minor significance in this connection. Meanwhile, however, the general crisis in German missions has sharpened. The attempts of the leaders of the Geneva-linked German Protestant Missionary Council to bring about a new theological consensus by calling a special study conference in March last year have only resulted in a clearer apprehension of the theological disunity of its members, especially as regards to their attitude to the authority of Scripture and their apprehension of the ecumenical movement. The ecumenical program of combating racism has deeply shaken the remaining confidence of some evangelical societies in the Geneva cause. Thus, the German Conference of Evangelical Missions, in which 35 evangelical missions are organized, as I stated, decided to strengthen its organization and has finally adopted the Frankfurt Declaration as a statement containing its understanding of mission. This was done under the presupposition that within that conference, several views of the Church and its sacraments are represented, and that consent given to the Frankfurt Declaration does not mean to them the adoption of one particular interpretation of these concepts. A significant feature of that conference was the presence of three leading members of the Evangelical Lutheran Free Church and its missions, who also are active in the Kirchliche Sammlung um Bibel und Bekenntnis, the confessional Lutheran movement which fights together with the confession movement No Other Gospel on the basis of the Lutheran confessional books. These theologians realize that the time has come to seek a new alliance in mission between all groups who seek to promote mission work in faithfulness to the biblical basis of Christian mission, as opposed to its growing disillusion in the ecumenical movement, which has also affected the German Protestant Missionary Council. There are some serious obstacles to such alliance of conservative Christians of different schools. While the Lutheran group cannot separate faithfulness to biblical standards from its loyalty to the historic Lutheran confessions, the general outlook of other conservative evangelicals is still predominantly Calvinistic and in some instances even Baptist. So there is a hesitation on both sides to draw more closely together. But on the other hand, faithfulness to its historic confessional statement did not prevent the Evangelical Lutheran Free Church from membership and cooperation within the much wider and inclusive German Protestant Missionary Council, which has no theological basis whatsoever. The question is whether in our present age our apologetical thinking and our confessional emphasis must still be focused on those issues which were at stake during the Lutheran Calvinistic confrontations of the 16th century. They have not become obsolete, I agree, and we cannot compromise about sacramental realism as maintained by the Lutheran confessions. But seen in relationship to the theological or ideological challenges by which we are faced today, sacramental realism becomes an issue of secondary significance compared with the complete destruction of biblical authority and even the Christian concept of God and his final atoning work in Jesus Christ in current ecumenical theology. This situation, therefore, calls for a getting together of all Christian forces which still are concerned about the urgency of carrying out the Great Commission to preach the good news to the unevangelized world as the most important task of the Church prior to the second coming of Christ. And I think that here especially Lutherans have to make an important contribution. It can be clearly proved statistically that the greatest passion to push ahead into the still unevangelized world is to be found amongst the conservative evangelicals. But their zeal for soul-winning evangelism is sometimes counteracted by an insufficient apprehension of the reality of the unity of the Christian Church, and also by a lack of doctrinal and apologetical awareness. This spiritualism and enthusiasm often is the very seedbed of radical modernist ideas, which for other innerworldly concerns that arise and destroy the reality of the visible Church in order to transform it into an instrument of social, theological, and political action. So it can be proved that sometimes theological radicals today come from the camp of conservative evangelicals. Lutheran orthodoxy and conservative evangelicals therefore need to get together and cross-fertilize each other for a more adequate sharing in Christ's mission. And I do think that the Frankfurt Declaration here offers a doctrinal basis which is equally near to both positions, because both have already made their contributions to it and have responded equally positively. But I do not think that a mere formalistic adoption of the Frankfurt Declaration will be enough. The Declaration must not become a fetish. We have realized long ago that it needs to be more utilized in two respects. First of all, many people have asked for a more popular version which can convey its main concern even to such common Christians who do not have the theological education to recognize the actual heresies which are refuted by it. Our Frankfurt group has already produced a draft for such a popular version, which we intend to distribute amongst the congregations. Secondly, there are still quite a number of issues which are only touched in the Frankfurt Declaration, which need further and deeper clarification. I'm thinking, for example, about the relation between verbal witness and social service as the two sides of the total mission of the Church. Particularly in Asia, theologians wanted to know more about the significance of Eastern religions in the light of biblical revelation. I think it is really high time that missiologists all over the world who are in basic agreement with the Frankfurt Declaration should start to go more deeply into these issues and to communicate their ideas to each other. If we are asking for a missionary strategy for the 70s, I think such strategy cannot confine itself to practical methods and to the reshaping of structures. It needs to be based upon a solid doctrinal foundation. Could not the Frankfurt Declaration be used as one starting point for such a new worldwide venture? Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Just as briefly as I can, and these are only starters. I hope someone will give me an occasion to come back again later on in the evening. One thing that has to be said has absolutely nothing to do with the substance of tonight's discussion, and that is that the journal, which Professor Beierhaus refers to as the Concordia Bulletin, you should know, is not called the Concordia Bulletin at all. It's the Concordia Theological Monthly. Now, two disclaimers come to mind, and I can think of more. First of all, when I read the Frankfurt Declaration, I feel impelled to say either one of two things. Either when I look at the affirmations and the we reject, the position of the affirmers and the position of the opponents who are here repudiated, I'm inclined to say one of two things. Either a pox on both your houses, and that would be a very nasty thing to say, or to say more affirmatively, there might just be truth in both sides, which would be perhaps a little bit too uncritical. But to put it more moderately and perhaps more intelligently, the point I'd like to make as my first disclaimer is this, that I certainly, for any criticisms that I would want to level against the Frankfurt Declaration, would not by that token want to become identified with a position they're opposed. I hope that unhappy disjunction, any critic of the Frankfurt Declaration is not to be caught in. I don't know whether the positions which are repudiated in the Frankfurt Declaration accurately and faithfully reflect the positions of the people the Frankfurt Declaration has in mind. I will assume that it does accurately reflect those positions. All I can say is that if it does, I wouldn't want to be identified with those positions. But, on the other hand, and this is my second disclaimer, while I am, of course, in utter agreement with that initial paragraph of each one of the seven theses of the Frankfurt Declaration, which is a direct quote from the Scriptures, and I hasten to add that I think, as I'm sure Professor Beierhaus would say too, it's probably the best part of the Frankfurt Declaration. I'm not nearly so sure, in most of the cases, whether the exegesis which follows from those passages does indeed follow from them, or at least does justice to them in each and every case. And the points at which it may not do justice to the overarching scripture passages are not, I would plead, as I thought I heard Professor Beierhaus suggest, simply the favorite theological points of each and every one of us. Now, those are the two disclaimers. One more point and I'll stop, at least for the moment. I think if of all the wonderful things and certainly fascinating things that I heard from Professor Beierhaus's presentation this evening, and a good part of the story of the Declaration was revealing and was news, the part I think I found most exciting came in his last of his four points, and way at the end of the fourth point, in which, if I heard him correctly, he was suggesting what I'd been listening for all along, what provision is made by the signers of the Frankfurt Declaration for improving it? And I thought I heard him say that that's very much in his purview. And he even went so far as to suggest some of the specific items on which, if not improvement, at least expansion and elaboration are in place. And those interest me very much. And perhaps there'll be occasion for him to elaborate those even further. I'll stop now.
I guess my reaction will be a little from a different perspective. I have been spending the last 5 years kind of in a much smaller area than considering world missions. It's been considering one specific mission, the one that I was called to in a small black community in St. Louis County. And maybe that'll give us another perspective with which to, you know, review the whole mission bag that Dr. Barhouse is talking about. So it might be helpful just to say a few things that I utilize, or I think I utilize, in determining what should be the mission of a small congregation in a town of 6,000 in which there are 35 churches. I guess it revolves mostly around relating one of the things that Dr. Barhouse mentioned again very close to the end of his presentation, the relationship of the verbal word to social service. It is this thrust which has taken up most of our energy in trying to determine exactly how that is carried out in our particular community. Some general principles. A, I've always viewed my personal ministry as one of word and sacrament. Pure and simple, that's what I was called to do, and that is what I think we are doing. Ministry of the Word includes proclamation. It includes taking care of our words, watching our words, paying attention to words. Words, wherever they are spoken, whether they be spoken in a clinic setting and how a patient is defined, whether they be spoken with a group of policemen as they are determining how you define a juvenile delinquent. I think the proclamation of God's will and his gospel has something to say in these arenas. The ministry of sacrament, which in its essence is social action. There's, you know, I think the sacraments of baptism and the Lord's Supper are social action, and they are the prototype of all Christian social action and social service. So, that is what we are sent to do. The target is some kind of a concept of the whole man. We have, I guess I have been quoted as saying that what we are attempting to do is put flesh and blood on the mission affirmations of the Missouri Synod's 1965 convention, and I think that's a reasonable statement about what our attempt in our congregation in that community is about. It is an attempt to carry those mission affirmations out, to design structures, to design ways, to design attitudes, to talk about ways, however it might be, to carry out a concept of the whole man. So that's why we are doing what we are doing. I think, you know, perhaps the problem is a little different in the community, like I said before, where there are 35 churches. Our concern is how do we build up the congregation, and how does the congregation itself carry out its mission in such a community. So we have been involved in liturgical renewal, an attempt to get back to the roots of the sacramental closeness and connection of the sacraments to everyday life and its message to everyday life. A real attempt to see them as something that are not only done in church, but something which do bring indeed the life that God gives. One other major principle, I guess, is that we have operated with, that it is always a false dilemma to separate verbal action from and social service, to separate words from actions, to separate soul from body, to separate evangelism from social ministry. That tension, to me, is a false one, and I have a difficult time understanding how we always get involved in that kind of battle. So with those two little introductions, let's see what happens with that. All right, you've heard from our whole panel at this moment, and now we welcome comments, questions from all of you. Brother Fred Pankow. Brother Pankow is the Area Secretary for Latin America of the Board of Missions of the Missouri Synod. You're directing the question to Professor Beierhaus, right?
It depends what is meant by the phrase, he supports the present regime. If we can interpret the statement in the lines of Romans chapter 13, to be faithful to any human authority which has been given the power to administer, then of course it is his normal duty as a Christian and also as a minister to be in support of his regime. If, however, it is meant that he should support the Marxist ideology of Fidel Castro, then of course this would be incompatible with his Christian vocation, and he had to reject this invitation. Yes, I was given a copy the other day and have been able to study them this morning. And I must say that I find very many helpful indications given in this paper. And just as I now listen to the report which was given by Reverend Menzing, how they are trying to carry these affirmations out in practice, I'm still in agreement. The date when this when these affirmations were issued was in 1965, which means prior to most of the developments in the WCC, which have caused us so much headache. For example, the World Conference on Church and Society in Geneva in 1966, and the Uppsala Assembly in 1968. And therefore, the document doesn't make any indication that it has already tackled these issues in a theological way. Therefore, as for their affirmations, how to do practical mission work, I would find myself in agreement with most of what is said here, but I would not regard this document as sufficient in dealing with the real depth of the theological crisis in mission today. I must also confess, now this is maybe a little bit critical, that the first part of these affirmations, which always start with whereas, where you now come with an exegetical exposition or reference to the traditional Lutheran doctrine, do not necessarily force us to draw the conclusions which are drawn in the second part we resolve. Because what is said here in the second part we resolve can be found in many other statements which are not necessarily made by Luther Missourians. And so there is also only a very light connection between these two parts. So the same charge could be raised against this document, as we heard it in the first response to the Frankfurt Declaration, that the affirmations of the Frankfurt Declaration are not a faithful exegesis of the texts which are put on the top. So this is sometimes our danger, that we first have a clear practical concept, and then afterwards we want to give a theological justification for that, and so we put something on top.
Professor Walter Boomer, visiting professor in 30 Seminary right now.
Could you please repeat your second statement, because I was not able to reassure what you were referring to, speaking about the reality which Jesus is that and I have to look for the German original of the version. Yes, good. Now, your first charge was the Calvinistic influence upon the second or the seven thesis, where we affirm that the glorification of the name of the one God is the first and supreme goal of mission. We found this to be necessary, to be stated here very clearly, in view of the very strong humanistic a trend which is dominating present-day ecumenical mission thinking. And I think this humanism, again, might be the last consequence of a man-centered theology which you had long before the present development took place. I mean, even if we analyze some of the pietistic mission hymns or songs, where always the "I have found my Savior" or something similar is pointed out, you get this strong anthropocentric idea. And I think this is the route then later for secularizing the same idea and putting man's physical welfare at the top of missionary aims. Now, the reference to the glorification of God can, of course, be sustained by Calvinistic theology. And I do not know why good points in Calvinistic theology should not be considered by us and even be adopted by us, unless you could prove that this Calvinistic concern for the gloire de Dieu is something heretical against the spirit of the scriptures, which it is not. There are studies about the mission in theology of both the Old Testament and the New Testament, done both by Dutch Reformed theologians but also by Scandinavian Lutheran theologians, which clearly point out that the one and sole aim of the OT thought of mission is to give praise to God, and that the salvation of man comes only after this has been pointed out very clearly. So in this case, if you say that Lutherans would not endorse this, Lutherans would have the weight of the Bible against themselves. And in this case, I would rather stand with Calvinists with the Bible than with Lutherans against the Bible. But I would still not endorse your statement, because it can be pointed out very clearly that Martin Luther and his theology is theocentric. And you know, of course, the book written by Watson, Let God Be God, it is his main concern that man doesn't taste the grace of God. Now, the second point is the question of the real presence of God in the midst of his church. Here the German text is den Gliedern der Gemeinde schenkt der Heilige Geist durch das Evangelium die Sakramente, das neue Leben und eine geistliche Gemeinschaft mit dem real bei ihnen gegenwärtigen Gott und untereinander, die in Ewigkeit Bestand hat. Now, this must be understood as opposing certain statements which come up again and again in the writings, for example, of Johann Christian Huckendijk, especially in his contributions to the book Planning and Mission, where he has an essay, some remarks about the word mission and missionary. And there he blames traditional mission thought for Baalism, which means they believe in a residential God who resides in the midst of his church, whilst in fact we have to adore a God who is always ahead of us. The Old Testament concept of God is the God who precedes his people in the desert of Sinai, and therefore we have to follow him. And now to locate God again in the middle of his church and therefore become church-centered is relapsing into Baalism. Now for Huckendijk, this argument is the pretext actually to dissolve the whole idea of the church whatsoever. And he has to do so because as a Calvinist, he has no understanding for the Lutheran concept of the real presence of the Lord through the word and the sacrament in his church. And therefore, he can locate God in a general historical development in the world, and therefore ask the church to dissolve itself into the world. Now, in this way, he loses completely touch with the New Testament concept of the church being the body of Christ. So therefore, you cannot come in fellowship with the New Testament concept of God, with God himself, the Father of Jesus Christ, outside the church, by being engaged in the world, being an anonymous Christian who is not really in fellowship with the church. So if you understand it in this way, you might understand the whole thrust of thesis number 5, in which, again, has attained special support, especially from Lutheran theologians in Germany who otherwise had been rather critical. I have a documentation about of responses to the whole Frankfurt Declaration. There's one Lutheran theologian in Lübeck who criticizes the whole Frankfurt Declaration point by point, but in case number 5 he wrote wholeheartedly in agreement. The last point is chiliasm, and now I don't know exactly in which particular statement is the one which you are so opposed against. If it is the coming of the Antichrist, then again is the question, is this anywhere in Lutheran doctrines denounced, that this world or this phase of world history will end up in an anti-Christian age where he will reveal himself and utter blasphemies against God, set himself into the temple of God, and in this way then dominate the whole of mankind. I mean, there are so very clear references to this in all New Testament and also in many Old Testament books that it would be hazardous to say it is against Lutheran understanding of it. Do you have an optimistic, universalist understanding of history, that things become brighter and brighter, so that when Christ comes back, if at all he comes back, he only has to put the finishing touch upon that which we have already established by Christian mission?
Professor Boone, are you perhaps in your tag of chiliasm referring to the words Christ will return and break into time, establishing his own visible, boundless messianic kingdom? Is it there where you're coming down, perhaps? Want to say a word to this yet?
Actually, this would demand that we now engage into exegesis, and I'm completely assured that I would be able, from very clear biblical passages, both in the Old Testament prophecies, beginning in Isaiah chapter 2, 2 to 4, Micah 4, 1 to 4, and then Paul, 1 Corinthians 15, and then the whole book of Revelation, that I would be, without any difficulty, able to indicate that this present phase of history in which we are now, which is that time between the ascension and the return of Jesus Christ, is a phase by which the result to the proclamation of the gospel is, on the one hand, belief and the gathering of the messianic community, the Christian church, the permeation of society by gospel principles, but at the other hand also the rejection to the gospel, a growing polarization, which then finally will find its result in an anti-Christian catechism. The whole New Testament concept of eschatology makes only sense if its focus is the return of Jesus Christ and his setting up his kingdom. If you take this away, then in fact you have made man the agency by which the kingdom of God has to be realized.
I think the question is whether this kingdom that he will establish upon his return is something that will take place right here on this earth, and this sounds a little that way here, doesn't it? May I return to the idea of Calvinistic sovereignty in your book, Missions Which Way, which I personally find better balanced than the Frankfurt Declaration. You, however, seem to be attacking the ecumenical theology of mission on this very score. On page 35, your sentence reads, "The theological understanding of mission for the ecumenicist does not proceed from Christ's great commission to his church, or you think it ought to, I think, but rather from the sovereign activity of God in the world." Well, that sounds a lot like the Calvinistic sovereignty that you were just defending. And it's rather interesting to me that Georg Fichtedam, who signed the Frankfurt Declaration, also seems to proceed from this center of the sovereign activity of God in his book, Missio Dei. So I find it a little strange, on the one hand, to be appear to be defending this, and on the other hand, to appear to be attacking it.
Now, just the sovereignty of God is most clearly established in the Great Commission, because the Great Commission is not only a command given to the disciples, go and make nations, disciples out of all nations, but it is introduced by the royal proclamation, "Unto me is given all authority in heaven and on earth." Therefore, so the Christian mission is nothing else than the proclamation of Christ's rule over the whole earth. And we find that this must be said first before we speak of the salvation of mankind, because Christ is the Lord of the world, no matter whether man accepts this offer of faith or not. He will be the Lord. But still, the intention of the Great Commission is to bring salvation to mankind. So this goes very clearly together.